All right, welcome back to the lecture. Last week, last week, last week. Last week we had our introduction into what we are planning to do in this course, and we started with the basic definitions of public key encryption and looked at the most basic construction of public key encryption that is based on the Diffie-Hellman key exchange, which is Elgamal public key encryption. And we had our first security proof of int CPA security of Elgamal public key encryption. Okay, so this was rather simple. The proof had our first game-based sequences of games proof. And it was kind of a warm-up to catch up with the ideas that were taught in the Introduction to Modern Cryptography course. Today's topic is to understand how to define security, because as we will look at more complex primitives that are used in secure messaging, we will see that definitions become one of the complex parts. So far we are used to look at complex constructions, complex security proofs, but the more interaction our primitives have, the more complicated it is to define what we expect from these constructions, particularly what type of security goals we require. And so the overall goal today is to understand how to define security systematically. And for this, we will use the example of key encapsulation mechanisms. We will, in contrast to what we saw last week, see stronger adversaries. And we will briefly look at forward security. Okay, so this is the abstract roadmap, and we will directly jump into the example that we will use today, which is key encapsulation. Mechanisms. And as we did also last week for public key encryption, we will start with specifying the syntax. So a key encapsulation mechanism, KEM, is a tuple of three algorithms, gen, eng, and dec. And the basic idea is that we have two users, Alice and Bob generates a decapsulation key and an encapsulation key using algorithm gen. Then Bob distributes the encapsulation key and Alice, and this is the basic, very simple difference to public key encryption. The encapsulation key outputs a symmetric key and a ciphertext, with probabilistic algorithm encapsulate or enc, just taking as input the public key, or as I just called it here, encapsulation key. Okay. Now Alice sends the ciphertext over to Bob, who can use the decapsulation algorithm to obtain the same key. Using the decapsulation key as well as the ciphertext. Okay, so this is the basic idea of key encapsulation mechanisms. As you see here, it's basically the same as public key encryption. The only difference is that public key encryption is more abstract and more powerful. So public key encryption can encrypt arbitrary messages, whereas key encapsulation mechanisms always encapsulate symmetric keys. And instead of taking these symmetric keys that are encapsulated as inputs, the encapsulation algorithm can just produce them internally, which allows for better efficiency, better security guarantees. So we don't have to trust the outside environment that produces the keys, that these keys are randomly distributed. We just produce them internally by ourselves with the encapsulation algorithm. And so the primitive it knows itself knows that these keys are good, that these keys have enough entropy that these keys can be treated as secure symmetric keys. And the basic purpose of considering key encapsulation mechanisms is that using symmetric keys for encryption is super simple. We know how to do that, so we can basically use another primitive here. Let's do this in gray. So we can use authenticated encryption with the encryption algorithm, the key that we just used, and a message. This outputs a ciphertext C prime. And so we can send C prime over to Alice. Probably we should add context information as associated data, such as the encryption key and the ciphertext with which we established the symmetric key. And so the authenticated decryption can take the key, the ciphertext, and the associated data, and the encapsulation key and the ciphertext. And so Bob learns the message. This is pretty simple. There are good constructions. I won't go into details here. The idea is basically encrypting messages is easy once we have a symmetric key, but establishing a symmetric key is not that easy. So we know how that works for standard cryptography. We will see the Al-Gamal encryption or the Al-Gamal chem in a second as a basic example. But for example, for post-quantum attackers or quantum attackers, building key encapsulation mechanisms wasn't that easy, especially if we want to have efficient schemes. And so for the standardization of post-quantum secure key encapsulation, or for post-quantum secure public key encryption, instead of standardizing public key encryption directly, the standardization or the call for standardization looked for key encapsulation mechanisms. So this is the primitive that is typically used for building public key encryption eventually by plugging it together with symmetric encryption. This is the idea. Now, the formal syntax looks as follows. We have a gen algorithm that takes nothing as input and probabilistically outputs a decapsulation key and an, and an encapsulation key. The encapsulation algorithm formally only takes as input an encapsulation key and probabilistically outputs both a symmetric key and a ciphertext, and the decapsulation algorithm takes the decapsulation key as well as a ciphertext and outputs the key. Okay, so this is the first step that we do when we define security. And our goal today, as I said, is to somewhat understand where there are methods and where there is a system, where there is a clear strategy for defining security. And the first step that we will keep in mind is we first have to define what algorithms we have, which inputs and outputs these algorithms have. So this is the first step. pretty easy. The second step is also still pretty easy. We are familiar with that one, which is correctness. So what's the correctness of a key encapsulation mechanism? We typically define it as follows: probability, and what's the event that we want to have for key encapsulation mechanisms as correctness guarantees?
Well, N gives a symmetric key and a ciphertext, and if we use DEC or decrypt on the ciphertext, we want to get the same symmetric key again as was given by N.
Okay, so our condition is basically primed on the output of the decapsulation algorithm, which takes the ciphertext. And we want that this is a key under the condition that the ciphertext and key and ciphertext, were output by ANC for this encapsulation key that was generated together with the generator, with the gen algorithm. And this should be one. There are a couple of constructions, and that's the reason why I want to mention that here. There are a couple of constructions, especially for chems, that do not correctness always, but just in the majority of cases, so in especially for post-quantum algorithms, there are cases in which we cannot guarantee correctness for all the cases, not for 100% of our executions, but for almost all the cases, and so epsilon should be small. And this is our basic correctness definition that we can use for key encapsulation mechanisms. But to prepare ourselves for more complicated definitions or for more complicated primitives than key encapsulation mechanisms, we can define correctness also as a game. And so this game should capture the execution environment in which a chem is executed typically. So we call this game correct for a chem that we analyze with an adversary that tries to break the correctness of the chem. Okay. So whenever I have whenever I have a dot in front of a line, this means that is this is a line that I will fill later. So this game starts with generating the decapsulation key and the encapsulation key of chem, and then it invokes the adversary who learns the encapsulation key. And if everything works out, so if nothing bad happens, then this game stops with zero, which is fine. So if the adversary didn't break correctness, then we are happy, and we are happy if this game stops with zero. And so, as I said, such an adversary that tries to break correctness wants to be able to do the things with a chem that a real attacker in the real world would also be able to do. And one thing that an adversary can do, so all the things that an adversary can do, are captured by oracles, just as in our normal security definitions. And one oracle that we offer the adversary to query is the encapsulation oracle. This encapsulation oracle internally just invokes the encapsulation algorithm on the encapsulation key that we just generated. And eventually it returns the ciphertext C. And also what an adversary in the real world can do when trying to break the correctness of a scheme is to observe the decapsulation of ciphertexts. So basically what we want to do in our correctness definition is we want to allow the adversary to execute all the algorithms that the primitive offers, such that we can see if an adversary plays around with these algorithms, nothing bad happens. So this is basically our idea of correctness. There are two different notions of correctness. One is that every time we use a primitive, everything that happens is good. The other version is that every time we use a primitive, nothing bad happens. And we will see in a second what these two different notions mean for key encapsulation mechanisms. But before we will see that, we first see what happens if the oracle for decapsulation is executed. So, of course, the generated decapsulation key is used together with the ciphertext to compute the key K. And then that key here is output. And so this definition here doesn't do anything yet. We will fill the blank lines in a second. But once we've filled them, we want to say something like, a key encapsulation mechanism is correct if for all adversaries A, the probability that game correct for that chem and the adversary output 0 equals 1 minus epsilon. Okay, so let's try to map the definition of correctness that we have at the upper part here of that slide into the game-based definitions with pseudocode in the middle of that slide. So what can we fill the blanked lines with in order to capture what we expect for correctness from a key encapsulation mechanism? You don't have to fill the blank lines immediately. You can just give me an intuition for what we want to do here.
certainly call the decryption argument with the C and then compare the K to the other K that we get from the origin.
Okay, that's an interesting idea. Let's say that oracles internally don't call each other, but that our oracles just give the adversary an option to call them, and these adversaries are unbounded. They can call oracles as many times as they want, and they can do things with them. But I think intuitively, what you said doesn't sound too bad. So assume that just the only exception that we have now is that oracles don't call each other. So maybe what we can do here, for example, in the encapsulation oracle, is that we trace the keys and the ciphertext that have just been computed. And so here we just say we initialize an array k that is initialized with this bottom symbol or bot symbol for all the entries. And now once the adversary calls the encapsulation oracle, internally we store which key has been stored or which key has been computed for which ciphertext. Interesting idea. We don't do that for now because it is not necessary, because our correctness definition will capture that case too. But yeah, the idea is interesting still.
Mm-hmm. We should check if it's the same as k prime. And if it's not the same, then we return 1 or something less than 0.
Yes. So in principle, what you said makes sense if we had bounded adversaries. If we had bounded adversaries, we wouldn't be sure that if the decapsulation oracle finds a decapsulation for a symmetric key, for which the encapsulation oracle later will produce a different key. So let's say decapsulation of ciphertext equals K1, and then we will query at some point the encapsulation algorithm with the same ciphertext but a different key K2. And if this happens, then we also violate correctness. But if this can happen, then encapsulation and decapsulation will output a different key for the same ciphertext, then it doesn't matter for an unbounded adversary in which order these two are queried. Because the unbounded adversary will find this ciphertext and these two executions also in the schedule that first the encapsulation and then the decapsulation is queried, such that the violation of our correctness guarantee will be identified in the decapsulation algorithm or in the decapsulation oracle later. Okay, so this is basically our correctness definition, just expanded a little bit and systematized in a way that in this case here, we just have two algorithms. We will be looking at algorithms. We will be looking at primitives that have more algorithms, or where the algorithms can be invoked in a way such that their schedule leads to different outputs depending on how the schedule worked so far. This is a little bit strangely expressed, or phrased, but the intuition is we will look at key exchange protocols for which the sender will be able to send something multiple times in a row, and the receiver will be able to receive multiple times in a row. And the correctness guarantees for these primitives depend on when things have been sent and received and so on and so forth. And so these types of oracle descriptions will help us to system or to clearly write down which correctness guarantees we expect, while this probability term up over there doesn't really help us to catch these correctness guarantees.
And the
which one, like, do you mean, this one here? So there is the case that this happens. And in this case, we output one. And if this happens, then the correctness guarantees are violated. The adversary does not stop with one. This, so, okay. Just a short break here. This is the correctness game. This is the adversary. The adversary is interacting with the oracles. And then at some point, either the correctness guarantees are violated, or the adversary just says terminate. And once this happens, then our correctness game says 0 or 1, depending on whether a violation happened or the adversary terminated without this violation. And so the correctness game's output is the one for which we care about the output and not the adversary output. You had another question?
Now we have two definitions for correctness, right? And the above one is weaker, or?
They should be equivalent.
But if you have like a malicious adversary who like knows one ciphertext which will always win him the game, isn't, and above we don't have like any algorithm, so above is just a probability.
So in both cases, we capture that all possible executions are considered. So in the lower case, we just consider adversaries that are unbounded. So this adversary internally knows for all possible key encapsulation mechanisms and all ciphertexts and all encapsulation keys, the symmetric keys that are encapsulated, and so it can directly identify those that are important and can. Interesting. Wait a second. Let me think about this argument for a second again. So in the above one, we just sample over all ciphertexts and all encapsulation, decapsulation. And in the lower one, we also iterate over all possible encapsulation, decapsulation keys. This is annoying. Anyone know how to? Low power mode. Okay. We iterate over all possible key pairs in both cases, but in the above one, the ciphertexts. Ah, okay, yeah. And in both cases, the adversary has to query the encapsulation algorithm on the ciphertext. So this is a randomized execution here. In both cases, the adversary cannot decide which ciphertext, which random coins are used for encapsulation. So in both cases, the adversary can neither decide the random coins that are used here nor here, just the same as here and here. The and here, the adversary can just input the cipher, like the only inputs to this oracle that can lead to the game being stopped with one are the ciphertexts that are output on the encapsulation side. And so both games consider the same execution that the adversary can just schedule gen, then eng, and then for one of the ciphertexts that are output, the adversary has to feed them to the decapsulation oracle. And so I'm pretty sure they are specifying the same probability. Okay. Good question, though. It made me think. Okay. So this is just another way of phrasing correctness guarantees. And typically, we don't prove any correctness guarantees. But still, we want to know what type of correctness guarantees should hold. And we will see in a second that correctness guarantees and requirements play a crucial role in defining security. OK. And that's where we start with defining security. And step A is adversarial capabilities. Okay, adversarial capabilities we can think of as follows. So we have Alice. We have Bob. As I said, two of them use the gen. This doesn't look too good. And the ENG algorithm. And the DEC algorithm. But they don't do this in an honest execution setting, but they have an adversary sitting on the wire. And the first thing that this adversary can do is watching what is going over the wire. So seeing the encapsulation key and seeing the ciphertext. What else can an adversary typically do when the adversary sits on the wire? Sorry? Alter the message. Yeah, modify the cipher, alter the message, which the ciphertext, yeah. Send different types of ciphertext. And what's the purpose of doing so? So what could be the purpose of altering the ciphertexts on the network? And let's talk about this very high level, like in a sense that we're not talking about chems here, we're rather talking about what is the purpose of an adversary sitting on the wire and changing ciphertexts.
He also changes the message.
Mm-hmm. OK, so we're still talking about key encapsulation mechanisms. So internally, what is encapsulated is a symmetric key. But true, yeah, this changes the cipher. This changes the key. For clarity, right now, we are just looking at confidentiality properties of key encapsulation mechanisms. So it's not about authenticity or integrity properties. But nevertheless, changing the payload, changing the symmetric keys in this case here, has an effect, may help the adversary somehow. So when the adversary sends modified ciphertexts, then what we typically do is we give the adversary this key. And what could the adversary do with this key?
He can decipher Bob's next messages if he sends a that key.
Not really. So the keys. The keys do not depend on each other. So the encapsulation here is independent of the next encapsulation. They do not relate to each other. But nevertheless, the adversary can choose how far the ciphertext C prime is changed with respect to the original ciphertext C in a particular way. So not just sampling a ciphertext C prime from random, but maybe just manipulating C just slightly. And what could that help us if the, or what could that help the adversary if the adversary also learns what the key for that manipulated ciphertext is? Maybe this is still too abstract and we should just, yeah, sorry.
It's all about getting the key.
Which key?
Like the symmetric key that is used for further
communication. Sure, yeah, this is what it is all about. And the interesting part is we're still maybe swimming a little bit too high level to know what I want to know from you, because I didn't give you all the ideas yet. But this is the ciphertext that may contain interesting information for the adversary. And so this is the key that the adversary wants to learn. And so it may make sense to change this ciphertext here in a particular fashion, such that if the adversary sees this key here, it learns something about the previous key. Sorry, did you want to say that? Okay.
Just one question, why does the adversary learn the new key?
Mm-hmm.
How does he get it?
We will keep that question in mind for like 10 minutes and then we will come back to it. Please remind me if I didn't answer it by then.
Question.
Same question?
No, I just
Okay, okay, sure. Okay. So, yeah?
I mean, like, we had like, if it's a practical example, we had like Elgamal.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of C, like C to the power of 2 or something, and you learn a key which you can use to compute the old key.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. This is a perfect example to see that plain Elgamal is not CCA secure. Yeah. But we will see what CCA security means in a second, and that these type of decryption oracles can be problematic or actually show real security issues, problems, weaknesses of constructions. Okay, so we will define our security definitions with games again. And these games have names. And these names of the games consist typically of two components. And the first component is typically what the goal of the adversary is. And the second one captures the capabilities. And we will focus on the capabilities first and then look at what types of goals we have. Okay, so the two games that we consider today are chosen attacks, either chosen plaintext attacks or chosen ciphertext attacks. So without specifying the goal yet, we keep this one here blank. We have a game that is a chosen attack. We will see in a second that these two notions, chosen plaintext and chosen ciphertext attacks, are very close to each other, at least when we try to specify them, but they specify two very different types of attack capabilities. Okay, so this is our game. And our game internally, again, just generates encapsulation key and decapsulation key freshly. Invokes the adversary, telling them the encapsulation key, and then at one point stop with something depending on the game's on the adversary's goal that we want to capture. And then we have two oracles again, and this is what we typically do. We try to allow the adversary to play with the primitive as much as a real-world attacker would be able to play with a real construction. Okay. Now we have two versions of the game. The first version. Chosen plaintext attacks. CPA and chosen ciphertext attacks. CCA. Okay, and so this chosen ciphertext attacks example captures the case, as I said, that the one victim, Alice, produces ciphertexts honestly. The adversary changes these ciphertexts probably, and the adversary is able to see the reaction on changed ciphertexts. Now, what I mean by reaction is that maybe you can think about that yourself. So your question 2 minutes ago was, where does the adversary get that key from? So this here may make sense. I mean, the adversary has the encapsulation key, and so the adversary can internally, by itself, compute encapsulations of key and ciphertexts, and so obtaining this information in the real world makes a lot of sense. But the adversary doesn't have access to the decapsulation key here in this case. Still, we give the adversary the ability to obtain keys for chosen ciphertexts. And so what is the real-world meaning of chosen ciphertext attacks? Why do we give the adversary the ability to obtain the full key of ciphertexts that the adversary can choose by itself? What does that correspond to in the real world? Why do people think that this is a good idea for modeling security of key encapsulation mechanisms or public key encryption or key exchange or whatever. Maybe you can think about the following. The adversary, so what we always try to do is we try to capture all possible attack strategies that we think are relevant in practice. And our idea is to give the adversary the strongest power such that we don't miss any type of attack strategies. So all the type of attack strategies that could happen in practice should be captured by the definitions that we have here. And one type of an attack strategy of an adversary is to observe a ciphertext on the network, see that ciphertext, maybe replace it with a different type of ciphertext or slightly modify that ciphertext, send that ciphertext to the victim. So here is Alice. Alice sends that ciphertext to the attacker. The attacker replaces that ciphertext, forwards the replaced ciphertext over to Bob, and now Bob sees the decapsulation of that key, or the decapsulation of that ciphertext results in a key, and now Bob will somehow react. Maybe the original protocol that uses the key encapsulation mechanism is typically sending back a reaction to Alice. Just a response, or maybe, I don't know, a flag indicating that everything worked out, or that, I don't know, an error happened, or the key was not possible to be decapsulated, or anything. Like, there is arbitrary information that Bob could respond to Alice based on the decapsulation that just happened. And this reaction might be visible to the attacker. And the most powerful reaction that we could think of is that the decapsulation, or the result of the decapsulation, is just published. There could be arbitrary functions of the decapsulation. So one option would be we take the key and we send out the last bit, or we use the key with another primitive, and due to that use, a little bit of information about the key is given to the adversary. The principal idea is that we want to model that there are some kind of back channels, maybe also side channels, maybe some kind of information that just based on the reaction of Bob to the ciphertext that the adversary manipulated and sent to Bob. And so the strongest type of reaction is just giving the adversary the key that was decapsulated. Okay. This is just the capabilities. The adversary is capable of watching ciphertexts that were honestly produced and watching the reactions of ciphertexts that the receiver tried to decapsulate. And as I said, we typically do not try to say, okay, this is just a single bit of information that is revealed by the decapsulation, or this is, I don't know, a flag about whether things worked out or didn't work out, but rather we try to be abstract and generic by giving the adversary most power that we think is realistic. And as it turns out, although this is very, very strong, slightly weaker forms of such attacks where the adversary has access to a decapsulation or a decryption oracle exist in the real world. So there are public key encryption schemes like RSA PKC as 1, I think. So there are different encodings that are used for the RSA encryption scheme. And I don't remember exactly which one is the most vulnerable. But if the implementation of this RSA encryption scheme with this particular encoding is slightly wrong, then with every decryption that is that returns whether decryption failed or was successful, the adversary just learns one bit of information. Things were successful or things weren't successful. But if the adversary collected enough bits by just watching that things were successful or were not successful, you are eventually able to return or to obtain the full message of a ciphertext that Alice was sending. So basically, the attack is as follows. Alice sends a ciphertext. The adversary slightly manipulates that multiple times, always obtains information, which is 0 or 1. And after a couple of ciphertexts, the adversary learned enough information to know which message was encrypted in that ciphertext. And similar things can be done to key encapsulation mechanisms if such attacks work. And we have to capture these type of attacks in order, like, if we prove that such a strategy cannot be successful, then we know that our primitive is secure. But for certain vulnerable schemes in which we would model such an attacker, we could come up with an attack and we could not prove security because this type of attack could be successful. So this type of reaction is a very minimalistic reaction, but there could be more type of reactions. So there could be arbitrary errors. Like there could be no first bit, like there could be three types of problems with the encoding. And so we learn more information about the message that was encrypted in this ciphertext here. And so the more information we learn from such a decryption oracle, the more we can use it to probably break the ciphertext that we were actually interested in, or that the crucial information contains. And so changing that ciphertext should not lead to any information that tells us something about the message that we are interested in. Okay, does that make sense? A little bit, good. Okay. So, next step is defining the adversarial goal. Okay, we will look at two different adversarial goals. There might be many more, and also there are many more different notions of adversarial capabilities in addition to CPA and CCA security, but those are the examples that we use today. Okay, the first one is one-way security. So we define game, one way CP/CA security for a chem with respect to adversary A. And so we leave this line blank and we generate a key pair . We let the adversary do something with the encapsulation key, and what it exactly is doing we will see in a second, and we will stop with a result that also depends on what we will be doing in a second. Okay. We will have a challenge oracle. And possibly, depending on whether we consider chosen plaintext or ciphertext attack oracles or attackers, we have a decapsulation oracle that takes ciphertexts. This decapsulation oracle, just as before, takes the decapsulation key and the ciphertext and returns the key that is decapsulated. Our challenge oracle first executes the encapsulation algorithm, is then doing some bookkeeping, and eventually returns the ciphertext. Okay, one-way security, that is something that you should keep in mind now, means that it is hard for an adversary seeing the ciphertext to compute the key that is captured or that is contained in that ciphertext. And so basically, it should be hard for the adversary to come up with a key for a ciphertext that the challenge oracle was outputting. And so what we basically do is we keep track of all the keys. And we finally capture the goal by checking whether the final key K prime is one of the challenge keys. This is almost our first notion. There are two things missing, and I would like to keep them missing for another few minutes until we come back to this definition, unless anybody has a question so far. The second notion that we consider is indistinguishability of ciphertexts. And this definition is almost the same, just that the challenge looks a little bit different. So we again have a game, in this case I and D, C, P slash C, A, against the chem with respect to an adversary A. And again, we leave one line blank. Then the game generates a key pair. It lets the adversary compute something using the information of that encapsulation key, and we again stop with a result. Then we have two oracles again, oracle challenge And again, the decapsulation oracle has one line blank, and then after that computes the key that is the output of the decapsulation algorithm using the decapsulation key and the ciphertext. We return the key. And the challenge is now slightly different. Again, we compute the normal encapsulation, or we execute the normal encapsulation algorithm with the encapsulation key. And we return the ciphertext, but in addition to that, we return something else, which is a challenge key. And this game is also slightly different because, as we discussed during our exercise today, we have a distinguishability game in which, or that is parameterized by a challenge bit B. Now, I guess that especially those of you who have attended the Introduction to Modern Crypto course, you will know that this IND, or these indistinguishability notions, they are basically focused on producing a challenge in which the adversary has to distinguish between a real instance of something and a random instance of something. And the real instance is the real key, the random instance is just the randomly sampled key, and we will return either the real key or the random key, and the adversary at the end has to guess in which of the two worlds the adversary was living, and so we output the guess that the adversary is doing to identify what of the two worlds the adversary thinks it was living in. Okay, so those are the two definitions of the games, but as you may have seen, this is not a final definition of security yet, because something is missing. Maybe one of you sees what is missing already. You don't have to give me the exact thing, but rather maybe an abstract term of what is missing. Mm-hmm.
In the first one, like the adversary could just query the ciphertext he got from the church oracle to the decryption record.
Mm-hmm.
So we would have to keep track of all the ciphertexts generated by the church oracle. And then
yeah. Let's think about this exact example in a second, but let's try to give it a name. So what do you think, what would you call this type of an attack that you just described?
Same ciphertext.
Okay, now I think my question is too abstract to get the answer that I'm looking for. But what I am looking for, or what I want to discuss with you next, is the last part that we have to define for coming up with a definition is trivial winning conditions. Okay, trivial winning conditions, and now we will go through all the four cases that we are considering today. One way chosen plaintext attacks. Are there any strategies that we see via which the adversary can win this game that work against every construction if the adversary tries to break the one-way chosen plaintext attack notion? Just as a reminder, the decapsulation oracle is not accessible to an attacker that tries to do chosen plaintext attacks. We have bounded adversaries, polynomially bounded adversaries. So for this type of definition, we define the advantage of an adversary in the one-way CPA game against a chem with respect to an adversary as the probability that the one-way CPA game for the chem with respect to the adversary outputs one. So do we see any trivial attack, or do we think that this is basically an okay definition? We are happy with it. Do we think a strong or a key encapsulation mechanism that is one-way CPA secure exists with respect to this definition? Because this is basically our ground truth. If we can come up with a construction, for which we can prove that the probability here is negligible when the adversary can query these oracles as it wants to, then we know that this definition is satisfiable. And if the definition is satisfiable, then we are happy. We don't need to restrict the adversary more than necessary. You mean that the adversary just outputs an empty element here? Yeah, this is one trivial attack, but I think we don't have to capture that here. Yeah, but thanks. No, but yeah, we will. So we are happy with this definition, I can tell you, but we can go one step further and look at one-way CCA security. And now you can, so we again, for this definition, the advantage term is defined exactly the same. Chem one-way CCA against the adversary is the probability that this game outputs one. And now we can look at it again, and maybe you can explain your attack again. Yeah.
So the adversary first changes, uses the change oracle to get a ciphertext, and then he just passes the ciphertext to the decryption oracle and gets the key. But it was the same ciphertext.
Okay, so the first step is the adversary queries the challenge oracle. Second step is the adversary queries the decryption or the decapsulation oracle on the same ciphertext, obtains the key. And then the last step is the adversary stops with key as output. And so the adversary is successful. And this works against every construction. Now, what should we do?
And if it's passed to the decryption oracle and it's already in OCH list, then we just return launch to something. Maybe return nothing, or I'm not sure.
Yeah. Exactly. Okay, for NCPA, and in CCA, we again have advantage terms, and these advantage terms include one trivial attack already. And that one trivial attack is basically the adversary flipping a bit and just returning that bit flipped, that flipped bit. And with probability 1/2, the adversary is successful. And so our advantage term is slightly different than the one that we have for one-way security. So the advantage in CCA is the probability that this game, indexed with challenge bit 0, outputs 1, minus the same probability outputs 1. We can just copy this. And now again, we look at the IND CCA security game and ask ourselves what type of trivial winning attacks, trivial winning conditions exist to break this game. Against every construction. So I can tell you, and I think this should let you all start thinking about what we're talking about now, there is a trivial attack, there is a trivial winning condition for at least one of the two games, for IND-CPA or IND-CCA. And I can also tell you that it's very related to the trivial attack that we had against one-way CCA security. Okay, so let's write down the trivial attack that you think is existing. Mm-hmm. So, exactly, we start with querying the challenge oracle. This outputs either the real or the random key. Then in the second step, we call the decapsulation oracle. This outputs the real key. And now in the final step, we just check if the real key equals the key that was output by the challenge oracle. If the two are equal, then we are, you're right. If the two equal, then we are in world zero. If the two do not equal, then we are in world one. And so I think what you said was correct, that the two should equal. Is this correct? So in world zero, we have the real key. If the two do equal, yeah, no, it should be not equal. In the real world, the two keys are the same. And so the output of the adversary should be zero. And this is why we check whether the two are unequal, because in the random world, the two keys are unequal with high probability. And so with high probability, in the case that the challenge key was a random key and the decapsulation key was the real key, we see that the formula at the bottom equals, sorry, you didn't see that, equals or outputs one, which is the same as the challenge bit. Okay, just to quickly summarize. Trivial attacks work against every correct construction. No construction can be secure against them. If there exists a secure construction for a definition, then there is no left trivial attack. So using trivial attacks for defining security is an approach that gives us the strongest security definition that we can hope for. Because if there are still trivial attacks, then there is no construction that can fulfill this definition. At least no correct construction. Because all the trivial attacks that we just use the correctness guarantee. The correctness guarantee says that the decapsulation of the ciphertext yields the same key that the encapsulation produced. So for incorrect schemes, trivial attacks do not necessarily lead to a real attack. So if the scheme for the decapsulation outputs a different key than for the encapsulation, then we cannot use the result of the decapsulation. So these trivial attacks are more or less And I'm a little bit hand-wavy here because it's super complicated to define this in a formal term, and there have been a couple of papers that try to do so, and so far this is an open research question, to capture these types of definitions formally, like to capture what the guarantees of trivial attacks are and how to identify them. But for these simple primitives, it's rather easy to see what the trivial attacks are. So finding trivial attacks is, there is no system for that. But once you found all of them, you know that you found all of them, because as soon as you find a construction for which you can prove that it satisfies the definition, then there cannot be a trivial winning condition anymore, because you proved that there cannot be a trivial winning condition against that particular construction. So you start looking for trivial winning conditions. If you don't find any, you try to find a construction that fulfills your definition. If you don't find a definition, you can start looking back at your construction again, or you can start looking back at your definition again to check whether there might be an attacker that trivially wins against a against any construction. Okay, trivial attacks work against every correct constructions. You can identify them generic, like abstractly, without knowing a particular construction, but it is not always easy to find them. And actually, in my research on secure messaging, there are super complicated definitions with super many different oracles. And so identifying which oracle in which order to query in order to find a trivial attack is sometimes super complicated, so complicated that I found, I think, 3 or 4 papers during my PhD that came up with definitions that didn't catch all the trivial attacks. So basically, these definitions were not satisfiable. Nevertheless, they had a proof sketch that was written down, but this proof sketch wasn't able to prove anything because the definitions were not fulfillable. There were still trivial attacks that would have broken these constructions, but these trivial attacks, as I said, break every construction that is correct. So identifying trivial attacks is not trivial, is not simple. But once you've found all of them, you can prove security. Okay. Now back to our definition of IND CCA security. What do we have to do in order to catch this trivial attack?
Same as before, so every cipher text we get from the chat oracle in an error, and then in the decryption oracle check if it's in our list, and if it's in our list, we return nothing.
Exactly. So we trace all the cipher texts that we produce a challenge for. And if the adversary tries to query the decapsulation oracle with one of the challenges, then we do not produce any output, because that output, by the correctness guarantees of our CAM, would yield the solution by performing the trivial attack that we just described. Okay, so for the final minutes, I just quickly summarize again what we did so far, and then we go one quick step further. Okay, so, and this is important knowledge that we will use for all the primitives that we will consider in the next couple of weeks. When we start defining security, we first forget about everything about security and just focus on the primitive that we're looking at. So we first specify the inputs and outputs, which is the syntax. Then we specify correctness. And as I said, and as I didn't fully explain to you, there are different notions of correctness guarantees. And this here is just a weak correctness guarantee. So typically, correctness means functionality. But in our definition here, we do not require that things are functional. So actually, our encapsulation algorithm can always output an empty string, or just a key that is full of ones or full of zeros, or basically this bot symbol here. So it can basically always reject and say, I don't want to produce a key right now. But if a real key is produced, then we require that if the decapsulation algorithm is executed with the same ciphertext, then the same key should be output. There could be definitions that require that this key here is a real key. It is not this rejection symbol, which is the bot symbol. And we could require this here too. But we don't care about functionality. We are cryptographers, we care about security. And the only part, or the only information that we need from our correctness guarantees or from our correctness definition is that if things are computed on this side, then these things should be the same as that have been computed on this side. And this is captured in this formula here, or in this condition here, that if the key equals our key that we computed on the encapsulation side, everything is fine. But if those two things are different and there was something stored in this array already, then we consider this a violation of correctness, and we require from all the chems that we consider that they don't violate correctness, and so always zero has to be returned by this game here. And this is basically just the long version of this probability, but as we will see, it makes sense to use this pseudocode-based, game-based definition of correctness. Then for the final step, to define security, we first think about what type of capabilities does an attacker have in the real world. And there are two types of attacks that, or two levels of capabilities that we consider relevant in this scenario here. And in your homework, you will do the same exercise basically with two different primitives. First, you will look at signatures and message authentication codes. You will try to identify, first of all, which capabilities exist, and then which adversarial goal exists, or which adversarial goal is relevant, what do we think an adversary wants to break. And the two adversarial goals that we considered here, first are one-way security and then indistinguishability. So this notion here means it should be hard to compute the entire key, and this notion here means it should be hard to learn any information about the key, in particular not even a single bit about the key. So if the adversary learns a single bit about the key, then the adversary can break indistinguishability, but just with one bit, the adversary will probably not be able to, or the adversary will not necessarily be able to break one-way security. So this here is a stronger goal, or basically it is a more powerful goal. And so an adversary that tries to break this here has more information. So it basically either learns the entire real key or the entire or an entirely random key. But the only thing that the adversary needs to do here is to guess a single bit. Whereas in this example here, or in this for this goal here, the adversary has to compute the entire key. You will do the same in the exercise for signatures and message authentication codes, and you will look at two different notions of chosen ciphertext attacks. The real one here and RCCA security, and RCCA security is something different, but you will learn this in the exercise. Okay. So as I tried to summarize, we first think about real-world attack strategies that we think think should be caught. The first one that we considered is chosen plaintext attacks, and in those attacks, the adversary only sees ciphertexts. The adversary cannot manipulate them, And in practice, there are situations in which we think this is sufficient. For example, I talked about this last week already. If we consider encryption to a hard drive or to a hard disk, and the only attack strategy that we think is relevant is that at some point the adversary steals the hard drive without access to the decryption key, and the only thing that the adversary then sees is a full hard drive full of ciphertexts without any ability to watch the victim decapsulating or decrypting ciphertexts, then chosen plaintext attacks is sufficient because there is no way for the adversary to observe reactions on ciphertexts. In contrast, in most situations in which we use public key encryption or key encapsulation mechanisms on the internet, an adversary can typically see reactions from the victims. And so decapsulation or decryption oracles are particularly relevant to consider all the type of attacks that we think are practically feasible. So as I said, there are two adversarial goals. Sometimes it's just sufficient that the adversary is not able to compute the entire key. But for almost all the use cases that we will see in our lecture here and that are relevant in cryptography, indistinguishability of ciphertexts is the notion that is important. In particular, because it tells us that we can treat keys that are output by the encapsulation algorithm as purely random keys. Once we establish all of these components of our security definition, we have to make sure that our definitions are satisfiable. And our definitions are satisfiable if there is no attack that works against every construction. Because if there is an attack that works against every construction, then we cannot have a single construction that satisfies our definition. And typically, these trivial attacks are based on the correctness guarantees. So just by correctness, we know that the decryption or decapsulation of the encapsulation will output the same key. And so all the challenge keys should not be output by the decapsulation oracle, because otherwise all these challenges are trivial to solve. And so we have to identify these trivial attacks. Once we did that, we can write down our advantage goal or our advantage definition. These two definitions are slightly different because here the adversary only wins if it produces a long output. This definition here is based on the fact that the adversary only has to guess a single bit. And so this single bit can always allow the adversary just to flip a bit and win with probability 1/2. And so we have to make sure that this 50% winning condition or 50% winning probability is captured in our advantage term. Okay, we didn't come to forward security yet, but this is the thing that we will start with next week. And you will have an exercise with which you can practice and understand again what these components of a security definition are. Are there any questions left? Not yet. Then we will see each other next week, and I thank you very much for your attention.